You're listening to No Plot, Only Lore, a podcast about games and the tables we play them at. Your DMs tonight and every night are Josh and Chris. You can find us on all podcast platforms or check us out at noplotonlylore.com. If you like what you hear today, please rate and review the show and share it with everyone you've ever met. All right, welcome back to No Plot, Only Lore. Last week we had a very Chris-heavy segment, but this week it's my turn to talk your ears off. We were discussing...
I don't think that's fair.
Well, it's equal, if not fair.
No. Like, I figured, like, if we just make every episode an incredibly Chris-heavy episode, then, like, that... Is that not what we were doing? I thought that was the plan.
By the end of the season, we will have a demographic of just Chris, so...
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Like God intended.
Yes, this is an autobiographical podcast meant for Chris by Chris, speaking directly to Chris about Chris. But for the rest of the audience, after last week's episode, we got to talking a bit about some of my other hobbies and passions, and one of my main hobbies is board gaming. And lately, there's been a lot more attention paid to RPG elements in board gaming. And so we wanted to take a bit of time to talk about what RPG elements really kind of means, because you hear that often applied to board and video games, and people saying that, oh, well, you know, our newest survival horror whatever thing has RPG elements, et cetera, et cetera. So what does RPG elements mean? What are the different sort of types of RPG elements? And they're broad definition, like broad categories that they would fit into, and then kind of give some examples of both games that have RPG elements baked in as part of the system, and some ways that you can bring RPG play, I guess play styles or play methods to board games to enhance, I think, the experience of both.
So that's like when I get really into Settlers of Catan, and I, like, put on my Emperor character, and I, like, slowly take over the entire board. Is that kind of what we're talking about?
Well, that would be an example of what I would call a soft RPG element. But let's talk about what RPG elements means first off. So I've got sort of five things that I've come up with that I would consider an RPG-specific element, and maybe some more will come up as we discuss them. But the first and most obvious one that I would say is... what I call a defined character. So often in board games, people are generally assuming some sort of role, whether it's you're playing Agricola and you are assuming the role of the head of a feudal farming household, or you're playing at the Gates of Luoyang and you are taking the role of a farmer bringing goods to trade at the city gates, just looking around at games on my shelf, you could be playing Barrage and you are a magnet in the hydroelectric industry and you are planning out your expansions, things like that.
A lot of those are really like kind of surface level, right? Like,
yeah, they're just
you're not going to have like a detailed character sheet for your Agricola.
They're just giving you a rough setting and framing the game as sort of this is what your role is in relation to the board and why you're doing these things. And in certain cases, helping to define and aim your play as to what your objective is as the player of the game. So, whether it's maximizing profit or making sure your family lives through the winter or just finding the coolest piece of art.
Yeah, so we're not really talking about like the creation of milieu, right? Like we're not talking about like the characters that are just part of the set dressing on the game. For it to be like a role playing game element, it's got to be like deeper than that.
No, when I say defined character, I'm talking about you have more than just a rough outline. You may be taking on a role with a specific name or a specific defined archetype within a setting. So whether you're like whether the game, you know, is a cooperative game that assumes you are a party of adventurers and you are given specific roles within that adventure, or there are there's other games that you wind up being given a specific, like the example I use is Pandemic, where you have a job that you are given, and that will vary from game to game based on random random setup, but it right off the bat you are put into a very sort of specific box of like, this is what your character is or what it does, and it has certain objectives that are going to be different from other people, and sometimes those things are more clearly defined at the start of the game and sometimes they come about later in the game, and I'll get to that in a second here when I talk about persistence. So that's sure. That's my first one, is a defined character or archetype that you are playing would be the most broad spectrum general RPG element. You're playing a role.
Is there like a cutoff point? Like how defined is defined when we're looking at this? Like are we looking at like it has to have a character sheet for it to be considered like a role-playing game element? Like is there a line where it stops being like just an element of a game and starts becoming more of a role-playing game element for you?
I would say initially, and this is really simple, having a name for what it, for either like the character like has a specific name, like Jeff, Frank, whatever, Mary, Sue, or you're given a definitional name, like you are the saboteur, the doctor, the engineer, something like that. That's sort of like the baseline for it. You don't necessarily need a character sheet per se, but a lot of these things will sort of come in hand to hand. We're going to be, as we talk about other different elements, you'll see that like it takes a little more work to separate some of those, so people just don't. But there are examples of ones that do. So I'll kind of get to those later when we talk about more specific games, but that's the first one there. So a defined character. The second one is, and again, these are not, you don't have to have all of these for it to be, RPG elements, but these are things that could fall under that category. So the second one is a narrative element. Is the story, or is the game trying to tell a story? And so that can be something as simple as the overall arc of the game towards an objective. Is that, there's a game, Tapestry, that tells the story of a civilization over eras. Does it have any other RPG elements? No, not really. But that is one that I would say is an RPG element, that is trying to tell you a story. And often it's a story that is developed with the other players, and your interactions with them. Sometimes not. Tapestry has very little player interaction, but other times they are an integral part of you have sharp elbows and you wind up rubbing with other players a lot more. So another, obviously this one is going to tie in a lot more to the defined character idea, but stats. So if a game has individual character stats that are going to be tracked, improved, relied upon for decision making, they're going to dictate how you play or what your main objectives are, I think that's a strong RPG element.
And to be clear, those are going to be like specifically character stats and not necessarily like environmental stats.
Right. It's going to be something often that you start with and is going to dictate the flow of the game for you early on. So whether you have, a very intellectual character who wants to do a lot of like technology research, or you have a more brutish character who relies more on combat and aggression, things like that.
I guess, like, my question on stats, I guess, would be, like, would a game like, would you consider a game like King of Tokyo to have RPG elements? Because you have a defined character who has a name, they have stats. Like, are those considered RPG elements for you?
I would say...
In that context?
They are, but they fall under one of the two broad categories I'll get to after this here. Because... Okay. While they are RPG elements, they're not like heavily implemented. Right. And sort of the definition for the two main types of RPG, like, inclusion in board games, I think comes down to a plurality of elements and their implementation. Okay. And so I already briefly touched on the idea of a defined role. You may not have a defined character, but you have a defined role, and the role kind of is the character. And then finally, one that has been coming up more and more in the board game world in the last, let's say, 5 years, maybe even a little bit longer, but longer the idea sure. of persistence, and having your decisions and your gameplay elements have longer lasting effects on the game and into other subsequent games.
Yeah, because I think I remember like the first game that like the first board game that I remember that had a persistence mechanic that I was really excited about when I was running the store was Risk Legacy, and yes. that was like 15 years ago.
Yeah, Risk Legacy, I think by most definitions, started the idea of legacy games, and that's why they're called legacy games. It took a little while after that for things to really blow up, and it's kind of mind-blowing to me that a game as old and sort of stale as Risk was the one that innovated this crazy new idea of both persistence and hidden information and secrets about the game. I mean, if anyone plans
that envelope.
Yeah, if anyone plans on playing Risk Legacy, there are some spoilers here, but the idea that they would like hide envelopes full of information inside of the packaging that you had to like cut away at was so out of the box for anything at the time, especially coming from a company as straightforward as theirs. You know, they make games that you buy at Walmart, and they were the ones who were like, hey, what if we really messed with people's perception of packaging and, like, game components and where you would expect to find game components?
There were people who I sold that game to who would come in months later, and I would ask them about what they did with the envelope, and they were like, there's an envelope?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, so, like, there were people who played that game who literally never found it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's a level of brilliance that I don't know if I've seen another legacy game quite match. But they certainly have iterated more on what it means to be persistent.
Such brilliant, like, game design mixed with packaging design.
Yeah.
Is just such a fantastic cross-section between those two. I'm still in awe
of that choice. Say what you will about Hasbro, every once in a while they hire someone really smart.
And then they fire them like 6 months later.
Ooh, yeah.
Topical.
Yeah. Ooh, okay. So now that we've sort of defined what I would consider like an RPG element, and this is by no means a definitive list. I mean, some people would even say like the idea of rolling to resolve actions is an RPG element, you know?
Like, yeah. I actually think you're missing a big one here though.
Okay. Go ahead.
Literally playing a role, like being a character, speaking for a character within the framework of the game.
Ah,
so
I did think about that idea, and the reason I didn't specifically mention that as a role playing element is that from my knowledge, there's really only like one or two games that explicitly ask you to do that, and the rest of it is something that you bring to the table.
Yeah, because the one that I was thinking of in particular was like Werewolf, Lugaru, where like you are arguing as a character within the framework of the game.
I see.
Regarding your innocence. So, like, I don't know if that necessarily classifies as a board game or as much as
a social game, I guess. Yeah, I deliberately did not include social or party games in this because they do quite often have you argue a role or argue a point of view or something like that.
Largely because you hate the murder mystery, like, genre of party game.
I mean, kind of. no, like, look. So I've done my fair share of like escape rooms, and I appreciate like the exit series of games as like an escape room in a box. Obviously, some are much better than others. But murder mysteries got really watered down into just like an excuse to get drunk with some adults, like back in the 80s. So I have no respect for them.
Hot take on the murder mystery genre of party games.
Like there are games that have you deceive people with your words that I didn't necessarily include specifically in the RPG elements, because like, again, I don't like, you don't necessarily have a specific role. You have a kind of character in the game. It's actually this idea called table presence, and the way that you present yourself from game to game as part of your normal gaming group. Like, you know, within the group that I play weekly, I am a aggressive player. I will often take the combat route if that's something that is viable in the game, just because I don't like people sitting back and like not engaging with the game if there's the option, right? So everyone knows,
well, my table presence very strongly, like, I am the antagonist GM. I'm the guy that like is going to tell you that he's going to kill you and like really hype up the combats and like this is going to be the toughest game you've ever played, and then I'm a fucking kitten.
Yeah. But like, you know, so like in my group, I'm the aggressive one. I'm also the one who will just go all in on a fringe strategy just to see if it works. Hey, what if I like did nothing but breed sheep for all of Agricola, the whole thing? Is that viable? Maybe. I'm gonna try and find out. You know,
what if I vaporize this dead wizard on top of this dragon?
too soon. It's been months, but it's too soon. I did consider that, because there's games like you mentioned Werewolf, but also there's a game that's been around forever called Diplomacy. And Diplomacy, you really do have to pretend to be a good faith negotiator as an ambassador for this country. Like, no, don't worry, we have your back. I'm not going to nuke anyone. You should give me, you know what, I'm going to tear up this piece of paper that says nuke on it to show that we've disarmed our nukes. Just kidding, I tore up a blank piece of paper. Stuff like that, right? You know, but I wanted to stay away from things that weren't like board based. Just to put some boundaries on the conversation, if that makes sense.
Didn't want it like edging into like improv territory.
Yeah. I when I wanted to talk about RPGs and board games, I wanted to sort of define board games as games on boards, because, you know, and sometimes they're card based or whatever. But the idea being like, I didn't want every interactive social experience to fall under this broad web of board game. Right. You know, is a LARP a board game now? Like, so
I mean, I'd make an argument for it, but
yeah, you would argue with me about just about anything, but
it's a game at which I'm bored.
Yeah. It's a game which I use a board pretending that it's a real sword. Okay, so now that we have sort of a rough definition of what I would consider an RPG element, I think all of the elements combined in certain amounts, which is not an exact science, but broadly speaking, they fall into two categories. There are the hard RPG elements. So things like having stats for a character, having a character sheet, having persistent gameplay elements where your decisions matter. Those are very like concrete, rule specific type of rule, type of implementations where it's like the mechanics of this thing really have RPGs in their veins. And there's what I would call the soft RPG elements. So things like character and characterization and narrative, things that you can add a lot more of them to the game than there would be represented in the rule set of the game. And that kind of stuff you can kind of bring to a lot of board games. Again, when I spoke about, you know, how games have roles that you play or a general character that you are, yeah, I could go into a game of Pipeline as, you know, just one generic oil magnet, or I can come in as Big Brim Bill, the Texas oil billionaire, and like have a bad accent and pretend to shoot guns in the air after every time I take an action. Those are that role playing is an RPG element, but that's right. Nowhere in that dry rule back, you know? Right. Now some games naturally lend themselves to that sort of soft characterization. My first introduction to the idea of adding RPG elements and RPG flavor to a board game was, so a friend of mine, Jeremy, was the one who first started my addiction. And I blame him for every poor decision I made ever since, but
fantastic.
He got me into Euro games when I was, you know,
big mistake.
Yeah. When I was still just a tabletop war gamer, just a guy who could, like, read comics once in a while and liked Warhammer and had spent too much money in high school on it. And
such a fucking nerd. God damn.
I know. And then he introduced me to, weirdly enough, the very first Euro board game I played was Agricola with him. Like, he threw me in the deep end right away. Yep. And then I backed up to Catan, and that's why I don't have the same love. That's why I don't have the same love for Catan that other people in the hobby space do, because I was, like, I started past where Catan was.
I think everybody has kind of a complicated relationship with Catan. Because, like...
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I enjoy a game of Catan. I do not enjoy two games of Catan.
Right. I'll take a game of Catan annually.
Okay.
Maybe semi-annually, but...
I could play more often than that, but I can't play with the same group of people twice in a row because I know that stuff is going to get intense.
I will admit, I did have Catan sort of ruined for me by a particular group of people who played a lot of Catan, but also had weird house rules that just made it something that wasn't Catan, because they found the aggressive social interaction more interesting.
What?
Okay, so
I need more context for this.
Brief explanation. So they played a lot of 5 and 6 player Catan. When you play 5 and 6 player Catan, they specifically add a rule that adds a second purchase phase at the end of every player's turn. People are getting a lot more resources because there's a lot more dice being rolled. They're going to have big hands full of resources. They need to get rid of them, and it keeps the game moving a lot faster.
Yep.
This group deleted that and said, nope, we are just playing the regular 4-person rules with 2 more people. Except they added in this little wrinkle where if someone rolled a 7 and was about to move the robber, their decision making could be bribed, like, heavily. So rolling 7s turned into kind of winning a very small lottery very quickly, because people would give you exorbitant amounts of resources to not hit them with the robber.
Seems so weird to me, because, like, if you remove the second resource phase from the game, you have fewer resources that are going to get targeted by the robber.
No, you remove the second purchase phase.
Right, okay.
You'll have a bunch of resources and no opportunity to spend them. So you get this giant hand of cards, and you're just praying to God that you get through 5 other turns before you get to build one city or whatever, right?
Horrifying.
Yeah. So you're willing to jettison a good number of cards to make sure that they don't hit you, because you know he's probably not going to get to spend them anyways, and I'll be able to get them back when I roll a 7.
Are all of those people still alive?
They don't play Catan together anymore. one of the worst, like, times I've, like, one of the worst behaviors I've seen from my brother was the day that we were playing with people from that group, and we all sort of just silently looked at each other and decided that we were not going to bribe my brother at all. We were refusing to participate in the thing that he needed the most, which was resources from running the robber around. And we just said, no, you can't terrorize us. We refuse to negotiate with terrorists. And it really, really irked him.
I bet. God, oh, man. Because, like, I have seen some really big emotions playing normal-ass Catan.
Yeah.
Like, people take Catan very, very seriously.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the game encourages that to a point, just with the way that they've built the social interactions into the game. Like, my brother-in-law, great guy, love him to bits, will not play Settlers of Catan with him again.
Yep.
Just the second game that we played together, he was so grumpy and, like, actually angry at people at the table about a game.
Yeah.
I was just like, I can't handle that energy right now or ever.
Don't get me wrong. I love when a game elicits strong emotions. Yes. But Catan rarely, if ever, elicits anything other than, like, just strong rage against, like, and for, like, minor slights, like, really, like, yeah. I have been full out backstab betrayed by my best friend in a game of Rising Sun, and it's still one of my fondest memories of playing board games because he felt so bad about it the whole time, but it won him the game.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's baked into that game too. You have to betray an alliance at some point. Like, you don't get a choice. But anyways, getting back on track. So I went to play a game at his house. I picked up a game called Epic Spell Wars of the Battle Wizards Duel at Mount Skulls Fire.
I'm familiar.
Yeah. The game is, you are a table full of dueling wizards constructing elaborate, ridiculous spells to cast at each other in the effort to be the last wizard standing. I opened up the game. I explained the rules of the game to him. He said, great, give me a minute. Ran to the kitchen, grabbed four straws, and said, here you go. Here are our wands. And for the rest of the game, every time we were casting a spell, it added that somatic component. You know, like...
Mm-hmm.
Now we had to act out how we were casting Bigsby's big old ball slapping balloon or whatever it was. Like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just, and everyone who, like, you were given a named character, right? So, Pistor the Pissed Wizard sounded different than, you know, Faye Ticklebottom or whoever else was at the table. So, you instantly added that soft RPG element of this is my character and how they interact with the world.
I've had some interactions with Bang that are similar to that.
Sure, it's just
like you have your named character, you end up talking with a southern drawl for most of the game.
Yeah.
Like, make fun of all of the tropes.
Yeah.
So, and I think, like, not to get away from the idea of, like, role-playing game elements within board games, but I do think that there is also a type of player who is gonna bring that regardless of what you're playing.
Definitely. There's a gentleman who's I listen to his podcast, but he his name's Tom. He runs a regular group, plays probably twice a week, but he is we'll say infamous for adding completely unnecessary accents and characterizations to the board games that he's playing. If he's playing a game of Irish Gauge, a fairly dry train game, you best believe he's speaking in the world's worst Irish brogue the entire time.
All right.
So yeah, you know, RPG elements more and more are showing up in published games. It used to really be the realm specifically of the cross-pollinizing nerds who might add more to the game than was printed in the rulebook. Because a lot of games used to be just very dry economic simulators. Thank you very much, Germany. But now that the quote-unquote Ameritrash has started leaking some of its influence into other aspects of the hobby, people are interested in doing more than just pushing around wooden cubes and making the most money because they are a coal baron or whatever. This inclusion of extra RPG elements dovetails very nicely with the rise of the aforementioned legacy games. Some of the biggest games ever made have those elements in them. So I want to start talking about some specific games and specific examples of RPG elements. Candyland. Pardon me?
Candyland.
Yeah, sure. But I can't, I'm not engaging. I can't start down this list without acknowledging the impact of Gloomhaven and its sequel Frosthaven.
See, that's funny because you wrote Gloom down in the notes before we got into this this episode, and my head went to Transparent Cards by Keith Baker.
I will get to that one, but if you look at the notes, I did specifically write Gloom / Frosthaven.
Yeah, but you didn't write Gloomhaven /
Frosthaven. All right, whatever. So sorry for being why are we talking succinct about Gloom in with my Frosthaven? Own personal notes that you read over my shoulder. Gloomhaven, one of the biggest board games of all time. It's been number one on the BGG list, like, of all games. I don't think it deserves to be there necessarily, but I understand its cultural impact and its appeal.
I've never played it.
Gloomhaven is like literally taking an RPG and just making a board game of it. If they didn't put it in a box and call it a board game, you could be forgiven for thinking that it is just a new RPG system. Now, it incorporates other classic board game elements like deck building and hand management and things like that. But you are given a character with a role. You're given a deck that plays differently from other decks based on that role. You go on missions that are defined through the campaign book to accomplish certain objectives, improve your character, unlock more of the story. You make decisions through that story that branch to other different missions. You may lock out certain missions by not going in that direction. I'd say the...
I feel like you're describing the Ravenloft board game.
Well, funnily enough, I was going to get to the D&D board games as well, but yeah, that was an inspiration for them, for sure. I think the biggest difference that keeps, like, Gloomhaven or Frosthaven from being just like a new style of TTRPG is that it has a definite ending. There's, you know, I don't get me wrong, I know people who reset the game with the available packs and play through it again and make different decisions. That's great, but its replayability is finite. I would love to see people coming up with like custom aftermarket, you know, content for that game, but it just doesn't exist right now. And I don't know if the people who play that game are that type of person, if that makes sense. You know, the people who play D&D and Pathfinder and things like that love coming up with their own concepts because the way things are defined is a little more broad and they're given that flexibility. Things are a little more specific.
Creative medium.
Right? Yeah,
role-playing games are art, like we said in our last episode, and so that they are inherently creative and encourage further creation beyond the scope of whatever's in the box.
Yeah, like D&D gives you the rules, but not a lot of direction, and Gloomhaven really locks in the direction for you. And I know that there's a percentage of the people who just, they like the idea that it's finite, that they can finish it. And you know, even though I know people who've been playing the same campaign for a year, because it can be very hard. But they know that there's an end in sight.
Right.
So there are some other games that have come out in that ilk. I personally own one of them called Tainted Grail. But these are games that, you know, I'd say it's closer to like a choose your own adventure than a true RPG. But it does have...
Whatever happened to those books?
Again. Though. Oh. Were you the kid who would stick his finger in a decision and go and read the first choice, and if he didn't like how things turned out, go back and fix it?
Josh, how dare you accuse me of a thing I absolutely did?
Yeah, like, I distinctly remember reading a Choose Your Own Adventure with, like, five fingers buried in the middle of the book as I'm trying to flip forward to see what happened to my dog that turned out to be an alien from space.
Did you ever read the Ninja series that they put out for those?
No, I didn't.
I got, like, a boxed set of them. And I swear to God, there is no way to get the good endings. Like, I went through those books with a fine-toothed comb, trying to figure out, like, which pages referenced which other pages. And, yeah. Like, I didn't quite get to the point where I was, like, mapping it out on graph paper, but I was getting there.
Oh,
and every single time.
I definitely worked backwards through a few books just to, like...
Oh, yeah.
I'd read it through, like, normally a couple times, and I'd be like, okay, and what are these other endings, and how could I get there?
It's weird to me that we don't have more of that happening on the internet, actually.
It's true.
Because, like, this is a fantastic medium for, like, just writing fiction where you can take different choices. And the fact that you can, like, go back and edit those pages and add new choices and then new branches to your story, I feel like it's just kind of built for that.
Yeah. Anyways.
We've got a writing project now.
Yeah, yeah. One of hundreds. Yep. So, anyways, getting back to Tainted Grail. It seems to me that these types of games, though, seem to live primarily on Kickstarter. They mm-hmm. are large, heavy boxes. I think Gloomhaven and Frosthaven are the real exception that sort of managed to break through and just become a staple at your local board game store. My copy of... They are prohibitively expensive. Gloomhaven is considered, like, an affordable entry point because it's, like, only $200.
I wonder if that has something to do with the, lack of extra curricular creativity in the game, too. Because, like, I feel like Kickstarter presents itself in such a way that you already feel like you're a part of the genesis of the thing. I don't know. I don't know if I had a point with that, but it just kind of came into my head that that might be one of the reasons that that doesn't have more of a following for custom content. People feel like they've already contributed to the content.
Maybe that's something for you to research. my copy of Tainted Grail, I mean, just for the stuff that I have, is I think it was about $350. I did not spend that because I'm not a crazy person. I think the all-in pledge was somewhere in the neighborhood of $500.
God damn.
These are the boutiquiest of boutique games. But they're on the extreme end. I think there's a lot more examples of stuff that gets close to that without breaking the bank. I want to mention there's a couple of games that have come out that I wouldn't say they necessarily have very strong RPG elements, but one thing they have done is embrace the idea of a defined role on the team. So the two that I want to specifically mention are Sky Team and Captain Sonar. Sky Team, you are a pilot and co-pilot praying to God that you can just land this plane. And everything in the world is fighting you to do it. But you have responsibilities, and your partner has different responsibilities. And I'm sure if you wanted to put on the correct shirt and hat, you could really role play a pilot. Because the game does a great job of making you feel like you are a pilot struggling to bring this unruly plane to bear. Captain Sonar, similarly, you are the crew of a submarine. engaging in a secret underwater war against another crew of a submarine. It's great in that the game is played in real time with two teams of three. And you all have specific roles. There's a navigator. There's a sonar guy. There's the guy who's firing torpedoes. And you have to, like, make and pass and accept orders with each other in real time, trying to navigate where in a not, I'm going to say in a, as a poor example, but in a battleship style way, locating this other sub on your map so that you can take the lethal shot. But you have a job and you have to do that job correctly. Otherwise, you know, even if they, you find him on the sonar and the guy running the tubes doesn't fire the torpedo correctly or in the right time, you're up the creek.
There was a video game that I saw at Gen Con back in, I think it was like 2012, where it was like a similar concept. You didn't have the two teams of three, but you had like a very asymmetrical design in that, like, you had like this one person was your nav person, this one person was your communications person, you had your like tactical ops, right? And like everybody had their different jobs, and the only person who wasn't sitting at a computer was the captain.
Yeah.
Right, and so the captain was the one that was giving all of the orders for like what was going on the ship. And I thought that was a fantastic game design. I could never imagine myself getting enough people together who wanted to pretend to be Captain Kirk to be able to actually like play it effectively. So that sounds like a lot of fun, being a...
There was an iOS game, actually, that I played years ago that had kind of a similar vibe, but you would just get like three random strangers together or whatever.
Right.
And you'd link up your phones via Bluetooth in the app, and everyone would get a portion of a console or a command center. Okay. And you're trying to keep this spaceship from exploding. But the commands that appear on your screen are not necessarily for you.
Oh.
So you're having to call out instructions that are quite probably appearing on someone else's screen, who is then trying to simultaneously listen and like do the action while yelling out the instructions from their screen. It was chaos, but like they were fast games. It was super fun.
To bring it back to like an RPG thing, have you seen the like Star Wars 5e rules?
No.
So it's a fan project because Wizards doesn't have the Star Wars license anymore.
Right.
But they have some of the slickest ship to ship combat rules I have ever seen.
Nice.
Where like your ship has attributes that are similar to a character's attributes, and you add those attributes to your own attributes when trying to do things for the ship.
Okay.
Right, so if the pilot is trying to do something that involves dexterity, they take their dexterity, add the ship's dexterity, and add that to the roll.
I see.
Right. Doing the same thing with gunners. You have your bonus to strike, the ship has its bonus to strike, you're shooting, and then you add all of that shit together. I thought it was just, like, a really clean way to, like, make those actions work within the concept, the context of, like, an adventuring party.
Yeah.
So, something I want to play, but I have to get through my next campaign without actually killing all of my players, so we'll see how that goes.
Well, so let's get back to
board games.
Some specific board games here. So, obviously, just about any legacy game is going to have some RPG elements, whether you're playing a campaign of Charterstone, and the world itself is changing based on your decisions and the way that your deck of cards and your character kind of plays from game to game is changing, or you're playing something as straightforward as like My City, and you're just kind of, as an urban developer, you're plotting out how the city grows. But right. I want to get into some more, I think, meatier examples. So first off, and this list is going to sound alphabetic because it is.
All right.
I just scrolled through stuff I had and added them to a list of games, so I'm not gonna pull them out for specific reasons, but I do want to kind of
the auto sort or something.
Yeah, I just want to touch on some of them here. So the first one, and you don't have to agree with my characterization of these things, but I think there's strong enough elements. So the first is Ankh, Gods of Egypt. Okay. The game is the final of a trilogy of strongly area control based games from Eric Lang. So it started, he's got Rising Sun, Blood Rage, both very popular. Ankh, mm-hmm. I think, does some of the most unique things. But you are playing, again, coming back to defined character, you are each playing a specific god from the Egyptian pantheon. Mm-hmm. So even though it doesn't like say to do this in the book, I think if people took 5 seconds to Google a little bit about Set or Horus or Anubis or what have you, they could and do, in my case, add a lot of characterization both to how you, again, present yourself at the table, but also how you play that character. So I was playing, I believe it was Anubis, who really likes things dying and coming to the afterlife with him. And so I just decided to play him as sort of a high school emo goth kind of guy. but it also, it influenced how I played. I went after more combats and I wanted mm-hmm. things to get mixed up and die more frequently. But it added a fun thematic element to the game. They're already represented in beautiful miniatures. Why not mm-hmm. bring some of that to the table? Watch that awful Gods of Egypt movie and try to play one of those guys at the table. That is a game.
The Mummy for inspiration, and it would be so much better,
right? Another RPG element in that game is that as your god levels up, as it were, you mm-hmm. unlock new specific abilities. So you're making choices in that capacity, similar to choosing feats in an RPG, you're mm-hmm. tailoring that god to behave in a specific way and be rewarded for certain gameplay. So I would say that, it has the soft element of the characterization and narrative in that aspect, and then the more hard element of, hey, I have to make like actual mechanical feat choices.
Now, I haven't played this game. Are those feat choices locked behind like individual characters, or are they something that everybody has access to as part of a pool?
No, they are locked to a specific character. Okay. So you as you progress your worship and adoration levels, then you start mm-hmm. making specific choices about, like, okay, I want to, get extra renown from winning combats or things like that. Mm-hmm. Next one is, I would say, one of the two examples on here that is just almost straight up a video game RPG on the table. So this is Arcadia Quest. I happen to have Arcadia Quest Inferno, but start of the game, you pick essentially a video game RPG character, some sort of knight or wizard or something like that. You are out there slaying monsters, getting experience points to level up, finding loot and adding that loot to your character to change how they fight. And there's a whole ass campaign that you can work through. So, you can work through just this whole series of adventures. You're tracking your achievements in it, eventually making your way to the big bad end guy. So Arcadia Quest and this other game. Sorry, just trying to grab the name again. Why am I so terrible?
Arcadia Quest.
Super Dungeon Explorer. Both play very similarly. Both have very similar art styles. The primary difference being, in Arcadia Quest, the bad guys basically follow an automa series of rules for how they will react to your presence. Their stealth noticing levels, based on facing whatever, it's automated. In Super Dungeon Explorer, one guy is the asshole DM who has to try to kill you with all the little gobbers. I find that a little more compelling.
You would.
I would. I absolutely would. but yeah, you're you know, one guy is just, I'm playing all the bad guys, and here's my monster spawn points. And did you ever play like the Gauntlet games on like?
Yep.
N60. Yeah, yeah. So like,
yeah, there's Gauntlet actually Legacy. One at the arcade just down the street from us.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Both games feel a lot like that. More so for Super Nintendo Dungeon Explorer, because it's got like, here's my like bad guy spawners, and all the bad guys spawn here and move away from there to fight you.
Right.
And if you kill the spawner, they stop coming. But both, I think, are...
The wizard needs food badly.
Yeah, both, I think, are like, very RPG-heavy from the get-go, very intentionally.
Yeah.
And both are very fun. So the next one I want to mention... So that one, obviously, that you can add the soft side of, like, I'm going to talk like a heroic knight, but it's very hard on the RPG elements. You have stats. This is your movement. This is your attack. This is your defense. So the next one that's almost entirely... on the soft side is a game called Cerebria, The Inside World. A game primarily, it's not a great name, but if you know the publisher, yeah, their names are kind of like that sometimes.
It just doesn't taste good. Cerebria.
So, the game initially is primarily based on diametrically opposed emotions. One person is joy and happiness, the other's gloom and despair. The expansion,
is this Inside Out the game?
In a lot of ways, yeah.
No.
The expansion actually adds a third element of what they call like balance or zen or harmony. But yeah, a game that about area control, but very much instantly aligns itself to like, yeah, I'm playing the negative emotions. I can just act like the negative emotions the whole time, right. And vice versa. You know, I'm going to be the positivity side of the scale. Well, then that's how I'm just going to interact with everything. But again, it is the theme. Like when you look at the art and stuff like that, really draws you into that idea. And then the soft stuff gets laid on so easily because it's expressed so much through the gameplay. You know, everything that you're doing is melancholy and elation and things like that. So just following the natural flow of the game would lead you to expressing those RPG soft elements.
I think you have time for one more game.
Okay.
Like almost an hour now.
Okay. I'm gonna rapid fire a few, then I'll talk about one. So rapid fire, Elder Sign, playing as detectives in a Cthulhu type setting. You are given very specific stereotypes as characters to play as. The school person, the jock, the detective. Food Chain Magnet, in one of the weirdest... Like, when you pull back from fantasy and futuristic settings and just talk about role-playing, if you want to succeed at Food Chain Magnet, you must think like a business-owning entrepreneur of a major fast food chain. On all the details from hiring to marketing to sourcing to what products you're bringing to market to pricing, you literally feel like you're just running a food chain. It's incredible for that.
I don't think my inner anarcho-socialist would be able to handle that very well.
No, but if you want to just take on the role of an asshole for a Saturday, then hey. So the next, we brought this up already, Gloom. Gloom is very heavy on the narrative elements. The idea that you're telling the story of your bad day for your family by laying out cards of calamities that happened to them and thinking of interesting ways to stitch them together. You have to approach dangerously close to the world of improv theater, but you're working more from prompts and trying to find an interesting way to string them together. Kick-Ass the Board Game, based on the Mark Millar comics. You're taking on the roles of those different amateur crime fighters throughout the city. So if you know anything about the games or about the comics or the movie, yeah, you could just become that character for the night. Last Night on Earth, similar to Elder Sign, it's a zombie survival game. But heavy on the RPG elements mechanically as well. You're given an archetype, a very specific character breakdown. You have a stat block that you can level up and weapons to go find, strengths that you play to.
That was actually the first game that I thought of when we started on this topic, because it's one I've played fairly extensively. And yeah, definitely heavy on those like role-playing game elements for sure.
Yep. Lost Ruins of Arnak. You might not initially think that the game about just like being Indiana Jones would be super RPG heavy. However, the expansion that added the expedition leaders suddenly has asymmetrical starts, and those different leaders that you play as have strong like roles and personalities in them that you can tinker with. Again, it's more on the soft side of things. Like obviously there's the very specific mechanical, like this guy wants to get a lot of artifacts. This guy wants to spend a lot of time exploring alone. But right. then they added a couple of wrinkles. There's a captain who's, you know, former military, and he's super like inspiring and heroic. So he gets an extra archaeologist to work with, in a game about worker placement. Having 50% more workers than the next person is very important. However, he has PTSD and has flashbacks and adds fear into your deck, because every once in a while something triggers him and he kind of shuts down functionally. So yeah, it just adds a really interesting character driven aspect to something that could have been just a boring asymmetrical, well, this guy's a little bit better at running around.
Fair.
Mage Knight is another example of like, it's very RPG exploration heavy. You are going to be building into a specific type of character, but the character starts from a lot broader perspective, and it's up to you to kind of define how they progress. But Mage Knight is an excellent explorative sort of RPG-like game. Near and Far, very strong RPG elements. That whole series, Near and Far, Above and Below, Sleeping Gods, all the stuff from that publisher. It has a strong narrative campaign element, and it comes with another one of those like choose your own adventure type response books where you run into encounters and it's like, okay, how do you approach this encounter based on, hey, there's people in my party who are like more compassionate or stronger or whatever, how are we going to solve this problem? And then you give your answer based on the potential choices and you know, suffer the consequences or reap the rewards, whatever happens to come your way. Already mentioned Pandemic and the idea of taking on roles. I will briefly mention Scythe as a game with asymmetric abilities. You've also got very strong like cultural based prompts from the different European lands that you're representing. So whether you're the Russians or the British or the Polish, whatever, you can add that element in narratively. It's not there persistently as a hard element in any sort of way, I find that it makes it more interesting playing into some of that there. Tiny Epic Zombies, again, another game where you're cooperative, you're playing a character who has an archetype, like Last Night on Earth, but smaller, faster. You're in a mall instead of a farm or wherever you happen to be, but it does a lot of the exact same things. It's just in a different packaging. But again,
name too.
Oh, it's great. And even narratively in the game, like, you know, the idea that you're going to wander around the mall, you're going to find a motorcycle and just ride it around the outside running over zombies. You know. Watergate, a two-player only game, but one of you is literally Richard Nixon and the other one is like reporters trying to catch him in a lie and get him impeached.
I hate it already.
Oh, like everything about the theme gives me the ick. But the gameplay is so good. And in order to win as the two sides, like in order to win as Nixon, you have to be a bastard and think like Nixon and go on the offense to throw off these reporters.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's wild. I wound up, I had the game, I played it several times. I wound up selling it, moving on. But it's still something I think about quite often when it comes to like, two-player specific role playing. The final
quick do an episode on that too.
Sure. The final quick reference is a game called Oak. You are a bunch of druids who. The reason I brought it up is because you have the ability to grant the different druids specializations. So one guy's going to have a pouch. He's really good at collecting herbs. One guy's going to be really good with animals and have a bird with him. Things like that. The narrative story that you build around these different druids and how they got their positions and the roles they're filling between moots, I think is fun. But again, it's one that you kind of add that RPG element to yourself with very light mechanics on top of it.
Right.
The game itself, great, but RPG elements, less so. So the final big one that I'll go into a little bit deeper, and you're going to hate me for this.
Oh, God. All right.
Is World of Warcraft, the board game.
All right. Podcast over. So, you can't see me, but I'm flipping tables, Joshua.
I'm sorry, but you can't talk about RPGs and board games without talking about what I would say is the biggest RPG of all time.
We basically just skipped Ravenloft and the D&D board games entirely and just jumped right into World of Warcraft. God damn it, Josh.
Okay, sorry. There is Ravenloft, there is Wrath of Ashardalon. They are self-contained adventures within a board game. It's the D&D people trying to make a board game, and I don't think they did either particularly successful.
No.
So, anyways, coming back to my real passion and love of the last 20 years, it's World of Warcraft. There's a couple of different World of Warcraft board games out there. There's World of Warcraft, the adventure board game, which is essentially a World of Warcraft reskin of Talisman, which is fine. It's got a little more asymmetric stuff to it, but it is, again, more or less just Talisman. So if you like Talisman and...
Not really.
Yeah, exactly. It's meant for people who already like Talisman, who for some reason also play World of Warcraft and thought, I should own two versions of Talisman.
I mean, there was a good time there where you could just assume that everyone played World of Warcraft, so...
It's true.
Yeah. Finding a crossover audience wouldn't have been hard.
Yeah, the Venn diagram was just like World of Warcraft plus X. So, World of Warcraft, the board game, however, did its god darn best to recreate the leveling and adventuring experience of playing World of Warcraft for 40 hours a week in a 6-hour game. And then...
Everything you've just described to me hurts my soul.
And then once you hit the end of the number of turns, it just devolved into a big PvP battle. The game was really fixed by the Burning Crusade expansion. And I mean this for the board game and the video game. But, it did some things that I haven't seen at the time, definitely weren't done in other board games. And I don't think really got repeated until you started getting the legacy games closer to Gloomhaven. But you have a specific defined character. You had a class, you had a race. Those meant something. They defined how your character played and what their advantages were. You had a board with stats that you tracked. You had a deck full of abilities and equipment that you would then level up and add to and modify, make choices on skill talents that you added to your deck. You'd go out and complete quests by hunting down specific mobs or just going to specific places, turning in those quests for experience to, again, level up and better your character. You could go in, small proto-dungeons, which were essentially just a very tough quest, but you could go and, group up with other people playing, because, in theory, the game was... 3-on-3 really at the end of it, but before then it was 6 individual people trying to do their own thing. I'd say 6 max player count, but you get the idea. You have your own objectives, but you could choose to just go to the same area where other people are and say, hey, let's work together to defeat this particularly tough thing and reap the massive rewards for it. And then once you got to the top end of that, then they had straight up end game raid bosses that you would fight or could fight if you got geared up enough in time and just got a little bit lucky.
So you're talking about all of this as though you're excited about it, and oh my God.
Conceptually, I love some of the things they shot for and the things they tried to do and what they wanted to bring to a board game experience. Did they succeed at it? That's up for debate. The fact that the base board game almost always ends in a PvP fight that basically just means whoever leveled up slightly more quicker wins was frustrating. There was very little agency at the end of it.
I mean, it does track with my experience playing World of Warcraft.
Yeah, it's true. But they really did add some more options and change the way the game ended to give you a more in-depth experience that you could curate with the Burning Crusade. There is one other expansion that I haven't been able to track down because I am a completionist. But it really comes down to, like, they, in, like, I think it came out like 2006. No, maybe a little bit later because Burning Crusade was out. Let's say 2008. They did their gosh darn best to put a massive MMORPG onto the tabletop faithfully. And I can't fault them for trying.
This whole episode had the same arc in quality for me as Game of Thrones. Just real great, doing good, everything's fantastic, and then we end it with just like throwing kittens off a bridge.
I don't care what you say. World of Warcraft still has like very fond memories for me. Those, everything's changed, it's all gone, there's no, you know, whatever, but it hit in a very important part of my life, and I won't be mad at them for shooting for the moon, you know?
Fair enough.
But yeah, that's sort of my TED talk on RPG elements in board games. I could talk for probably 3 hours about specific board games and their RPG elements and implementations, but...
subscribe to our Patreon, and you might get Josh do that.
If you subscribe to our Patreon, I will do an episode individually tailored to your board game preferences.
I will just be there to listen. You won't even hear me like quipping. I will turn my mic off.
I think going forward, I think we should have a broader discussion about crossover stuff and things that I think the RPG world could use to take and learn from board games. And 100%. I think we should talk about the other side of it too, things that are in standard RPGs that we would love to see brought over and recreated in a different format, the tabletop format that's 90 minutes to 2 hours as opposed to a whole Saturday.
Well, there are like proper hybrid games that have come out as well that are like, that this is essentially a role-playing game one-shot that came in a box.
Right? Yeah.
So I would be happy to get into some of those. Like, I've got a copy of Free Market staring at me right now, and that's basically its whole deal. So.
Perfect. Yeah. Let's put a pin in that idea, and we're gonna revisit that in a future episode.
Perfect. Hey, thanks for making it all the way through this episode of No Plot Only Lore. If you're looking for more, you can always find us at noplotonlylore.com and on all the very best podcast platforms. If you like what you heard today, please share, rate, and review the show to feed my never-ending need for attention and validation.